What are you curious about? It may seem like an idle question, but your curiosity is one of your most precious gifts. It's a clue to your deepest passions, and it might just be the tool you need to ignite your creativity and steer your life in a more dynamic and positive direction. Taking curiosity seriously as individuals and organizations is the project of Seth Goldenberg, a designer and author of the new book Radical Curiosity: Questioning Commonly Held Beliefs to Imagine Flourishing Futures. Seth joins us now to share five big, challenging ideas about how to leverage creativity in our professional and personal lives.
My name is Seth Goldenberg. I'm the author of the book Radical Curiosity: Questioning Commonly Held Beliefs to Imagine Flourishing Futures. I'm going to share five big ideas from the book for you today. The term radical curiosity is not only the title of the book. It is the core operating system of a creativity, imagination, and design studio in Jamestown, Rhode Island, where we have been working with teams of interdisciplinary biologists, educators, researchers, and anthropologists to apply the practice of radical curiosity in every sector, social system, and business you can imagine, from climate change to education, to finance, to retail, to public health, and beyond. The term radical curiosity, specifically the idea of radical, is derived from the Latin term radicalis, which really means the roots of things, the very deep anchored basis by which something begins. This is fundamental in the book, and it really guides the idea that curiosity is not so much the kind of curiosity that we're occupied with, is not so much a passive, fleeting curiosity, but a deeply intentional inquiry and questioning of the very roots of things. Big idea number one, curiosity is an endangered species. Our modern world has been designed to eradicate curiosity. And at a time when every sector of business and social system comprising society is facing existential challenges, the potential extinction of curiosity is an emergency. We need questions now more than ever. We often move too swiftly towards solutions, acting before we even know what the true essential question is that we seek to solve. We wear our action-oriented mindset like a badge in contemporary business, saying things like, "I have a bias for action." But we've confused the act of the transaction with actual impact. We reward the mere swing of the hammer even when we miss. Over the course of the 20th century, knowledge has become segregated, industrialized, and routinized. And we view thinking as a commodity. Leading has come to mean the management of pre-existing knowledge rather than the discovery of new knowledge. So many of us in our personal and professional lives get occupied in the transactions, the many routines and mere tactical activities that overshadow the questions of why. Why are we doing what we do? And do we have the power? Do we have the authority to question the trajectory in the first place? We live in a time of consistent paradoxes. We don't know that we believe education is working, but we'll throw you in jail if you don't attend. Our social systems are designed as paradoxes, and we're letting it pass us by. moving the chairs on the Titanic as we head into the urgency and the crisis that we didn't even recognize as the root while we work to manage the symptoms. Big idea number two. We are living during the in-between times. These in-between times are a kind of interregnum. In politics, the term interregnum is defined as a period between two successive regimes, a lapse or pause in a series, often viewed as a period juxtaposed between two different ideologies. This kind of interregnum is quite tangible, marked by milestones of change in government. But today we're living in maybe a more abstract, but no less significant type of interregnum, one that is cultural rather than political. We are living between models of how we see ourselves, what we believe in, and how we agree to realize those values in practice. It's as though society is stitched together through a shared code of what we believe, and we translate those beliefs into the way we choose to live. Just like an operating system within our computer dictates the basic functions it performs, culture is a kind of operating system that guides how society functions. A set of rules and behaviors and collectively accepted values that encode through millions of microagreements that keep the system running. But a cultural interregnum is about a unique moment in which the ideas from the past are in decline as we question them as maybe legacy narratives. And in turn, the new ideas, the new possibilities that are emergent are challenger narratives. This pass of the baton between legacy narratives and challenger narratives make up this messy middle of the in-between times. We are witnessing meaningful and diverse experimentation with the new ideas that often challenge some of our most deeply held core beliefs about ourselves and our business and our culture and how we identify what it means to be human. Legacy narratives often have a stronghold over the public imagination. They carry entrenched traditions and associated messages that reinforce the narrative, those power structures, and the signals anchoring the identities we live by. But as challenger narratives become newborn babies that are still learning to crawl, and then they catch the public imagination, they mature and they journey into a more predominant narrative. There's a friction, of course, a kind of growing pain that we experience between these two narratives. I think that's the moment that we're living in. Big idea number three. If we're living in these in-between times, they require fourth places propelled by civic imagination. If society is going through an operating system reboot, redefining what we believe in, what we value, big ideas from gender to the economy, to the workplace, to health, all of these ideas, these human conditions, how do we go to work on rewriting that code? How do we cooperatively, collectively experiment with which narrative will emerge next? Which narrative will win and prevail and become a predominant narrative or sustain as a legacy narrative? We need to invest in what sociologist Ray Oldenburg called third places. Oldenburg defined these as places distinct from our home, which might be the first place, and work, the second place. Third places are places where People exchange ideas and build relationships that strengthen social capital. He talked about them as the recreation centers, the parks, the pubs, the hair salons, the gathering places that bring cohesion to our social selves. But we're living in complicated times. Simply gathering may not itself be sufficient for the complexity of what we're facing. We need spaces which ignite the revolutionary spirit, the urgency, the attitude and mindset that we cooperatively can go to work on the future to define the chapter of what comes next. We need gathering spaces for championing unheard voices, examining emerging narratives, and drawing upon our collective creative capacity to build and realize new kinds of futures. We need fourth places. They are much needed additions to the three spheres Oldenburg articulated more than three decades ago. The future is a dimension we need to pay attention to because we are all stakeholders in it. The fourth place is where we reclaim our identity as civic actors responsible for shaping the emergent future. It is a place where we can bridge our public and private selves, manifesting a sense of purpose as we do the work of imagining and building what comes next. And that requires conversation. It requires curiosity, in part because we aren't so sure what could come next. Big idea four, the ultimate outcome of design is aliveness. I've been blessed to be a designer, to work with some of the world's most famous and successful designers. Design thinking has become a competitive advantage in business and civic life. But I also want to ask more of design. Sometimes my studio is called an experience design studio, sometimes a systems design firm. Often we're thought of as design thinkers, but I think we're only now beginning to just scratch the surface of what design really means and what the role of design is in society. What is the highest order outcome that design can offer? I believe that aliveness is when we experience the highest order version of ourselves. To realize such a heightened state requires imagination. Aliveness can only occur when we imagine a possible self that pierces through the mundane and becomes something extraordinary. This is the greatest gift of imagination. Our ability to bridge the gap between possibility and realization. When we watch the performances of our friends, our colleagues, ourselves peak at a performative event and experience and milestone, we are all moved by such an encounter. We are witnessing someone having an experience with the highest order of themselves. Aliveness is about our ability to love life, to show up for it and devour it as a meal. We cannot realize this by bringing harm to others. We cannot self-actualize without collective actualization. This is the great context design project of the century. It will measure the sum of us, not simply the singularity of each of us. It is our moral responsibility to be alive. Big idea number five. Imagination is the most valuable natural resource on Earth. In 2010, IBM produced a landmark study involving more than 1,500 CEOs from 60 countries across 33 industries, exploring what they believe to be the most crucial factor for future success in business. A surprising result emerged. More than any other skill traditionally associated with business, the number one quality CEOs cited was creativity. In the interviews, these executives indicated that in an environment of increased complexity and ambiguity that required business model change and the ability to invent and navigate disruptive innovation, creativity should be prioritized above all else. Yet, society does not prioritize imagination, not in business, government, or education. The evidence of this is staggering. In 2020, for the fourth consecutive year, the Trump administration announced that it proposed federal expenditure, ironically titled Budget for America's Future. Within it, it would eliminate the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities. The final version allowed an allocation of approximately $160 million for the NEA. More importantly, in contrast, that same year, the federal allocation for the Department of Defense exceeded $700 billion, making the federal arts budget 0.02% of the military budget. Let's just hold that in the air for a moment. The tools of imagination were 0.02 of a single percent of the tools of war. Imagination is a renewable resource. It is rooted in a phenomenon known in neuroscience as mental synthesis, our brain's ability to combine known concepts to make new ideas. This capability is considered uniquely human, something that differentiates us from other living beings. The wicked challenges we face are, for better or worse, outcomes of our own success. Considering that we've imagined the current state of the world, we can reimagine our way out of it. Maya Angelou once said, "Creativity cannot be used up. The more you use, the more you have." Imagination may very well be the most valuable natural resource in the world.
Thank you, Seth. That was five big ideas from Radical Curiosity, questioning commonly held beliefs to imagine flourishing futures. You might also like our book bite for Leading with Heart, five conversations that unlock creativity, purpose, and results. I'm Holly Morris. Thanks for listening.